Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Love, somebody once wrote, means never having to say you're sorry. Business, on the other hand, means knowing when you goofed and apologizing profusely. And boy, is Apple sorry. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 27th of September. Sorry. It's the 28th. But you know what? I'm not the only one apologizing today. Apple CEO Tim Cook groveled before customers and investors this morning. He admitted that when it comes to maps, Apple really ain't all that. Cook promised they are working nonstop, in his words, to fix their incomplete, frustrating, and widely skewered map app that has replaced Google in Apple's new operating system. Way more surprising than the rare apology from Cupertino, though, was this. Cook suggested Apple users turn to the competition for relief, Bing and MapQuest, and yes, even Google. From New York Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains how this could put other map makers on the map.
Today is Michal Hobdenk Kolichkovsky's birthday. He wasn't expecting a gift from Tim Cook. Hobdenk works for Waze, one of the navigation apps Cook recommended. And thanks to Cook's big apology,
it's going to be a record-breaking day for us. No question about that.
Waze, and that's W-A-Z-E, already has a 5-star rating in the App Store and claims 25 million global users. But a shout-out from the head of Apple doesn't hurt.
We know that people like us, but to get validated from Tim Cook, that was really cool.
Waze, MapQuest, Bing, and others will likely benefit from Apple's map mishap, says tech analyst Roger Kay of Endpoint Technologies. But he'd rather see Apple restore Google's maps.
It really should not have taken away something that really worked and given users something that didn't work. And to just say, I'm sorry, you know, here, try these, I don't think is really enough.
Kay says some customers will switch to Android phones to get Google Maps. Danny Sullivan keeps track of all this as editor of Search Engine Land. Don't forget, he says, Google Maps was far from perfect when it came out, and it's going to take Apple time to catch up.
What they're going to have to do is just as quickly as possible improve the mapping quality that's out there. And unfortunately, that's not going to be a quick process. It's going to take years.
Years that other map providers will spend cashing in while Apple finds its way. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
If you want to read Tim Cook's letter for yourself, we've got an annotated version on our Facebook page and at marketplace.org. The annotations, by the way, are what makes it, if you ask me. If you happen to be a long-time and long-suffering holder of Bank of America stock, you know it has been a rough patch. You've suffered bad acquisitions, lawsuits, company shrinkage. There was, though, a small bit of good news today, small as in $2.4 billion. That's how much, or maybe not so much in the grand scheme of things, that B of A has agreed to pay shareholders to settle allegations it misled investors during the dark days of the financial crisis. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Bank of America chose to buy Merrill Lynch over a chaotic weekend in September 2008, just as Lehman was failing.
There was a lot of scurrying going around.
Economist Lawrence White at NYU recalls as Lehman was drowning, Merrill needed a life jacket. B of A threw it. The buyers later found the new property full of financial risk they didn't tell investors about, the suit says. The bank settled without admitting fault. But White says B of A's payments come from bank owners, the shareholders, paying shareholders.
The money's coming out of one pocket and going into the other pocket. However, not so fast, because there are lawyers in between.
Who, he says, tend to get a third of payouts. B of A's lawyers are busy. The bank has been sued by customers, lenders, borrowers, the feds. By one count, it's paid $29 billion in settlements since the crisis. Charles Elson teaches corporate governance at the University of Delaware.
It's a huge number. That was shareholder value that went out the door. It was a result of problematic acquisitions. That had nothing to do with those who invested their capital in the company, and they ended up paying for it.
It's easy to pick on Bank of America. For his part, Dick Beauvais at Rockdale Securities is glad it saved Merrill when it did.
Merrill Lynch now would have gone under. The next step in the ladder was Morgan Stanley that was gasping for air, and then there would have been an attack on Goldman Sachs.
Still, he says, ends don't justify means, as in allegedly misleading investors. The difference between the two? $2.4 billion. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Depending on where you live and or work, you've probably been stopped on the street at some point, maybe at many points, and asked whether you've got any change you can spare. Everybody's got different answers, but in some cities, though, the police answer with a ticket. Anti-panhandling laws are becoming more common. But this week, a judge in Northern California ruled that one city's ordinance went too far. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has more.
How do you feel when someone asks you for money?
It saddens me.
There have been times where the individuals have gotten aggressive, and that makes me very angry when that happens.
They're just like an annoyance, maybe like a pigeon that poops on your head or something.
That's Linda Gray, Gordon Ownby, and Art Lopez in downtown L.A. Some of the worries they expressed were at the root of a law passed a few years ago, hundreds of miles away, in the town of Arcata, California. It banned people from asking for money within 20 feet of stores, intersections, and bus stops. Arcata's a college town known for pot farms, redwood trees, and lots of itinerant panhandlers. Mayor Michael Winkler says locals felt it had gotten out of control.
They felt like it was difficult for them to say no. Women with children and older women felt very intimidated.
A person passively holding a sign on the corner?
Richard Salzman is an Arcata citizen who filed a lawsuit against the ban. He also staged a few one-man protests, like standing on the corner next to a guy holding a sign advertising $5 pizzas. Salzman held up a sign saying, "Please buy me a pizza before I'm arrested for holding this sign." This week, a judge ruled that Arcata's ban on the simple act of asking for money violates the right to free speech.
Do you have 50 cents?
Back on the streets of L.A., I asked a young man in a dirty sweatshirt what he thought about the ruling after he asked me for change. He didn't want to give his name, but he said this.
I never thought I had to ask anybody for money, too. I guess you do what you gotta do.
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Wall Street was underwater right from the opening bell. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. About that time in a Friday show to pause and reflect, to digest, if you will, the happenings of the past 5 days. Here for our weekly wrapper, John Carney from CNBC and our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. They are in our New York Bureau. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so let's do this, Heidi. First of all, the B of A thing that Scott Tong was telling us about. Am I naive that I'm just kind of amazed, annoyed, take your pick, that we're still dealing with this stuff 4.5 years after Lehman went under?
Yeah, I know. We can't even have nostalgia because it's still all alive for us. But it's, you know, I think it's actually kind of a useful time for that kind of case to be settled because it reminds us why we lost trust in financial institutions, right? I mean, this is why we had Occupy Wall Street and all of this other stuff, which is big financial institutions lied to everybody. And, you know, it's nice to have that occasional reminder, oh, yeah, that happened, just when everything seems like it's going okay and we're at risk of forgetting.
John, do you share my amazement? Probably not, right? You're more cynical than I am.
I'm very cynical, but I'm happy that Bank of America was forced to pay out this amount of money. I mean, and it is a tremendous amount of money. It's not your typical, oh, we're paying a couple $100 million. This is, you know, billions of dollars that they're paying out on the grounds they were lying during the height of the financial crisis. When everybody was saying, oh, everybody's in a panic because they don't trust the banks, it turns out it was a good idea not to trust the banks because they were lying.
That's right. That's right. Never let that be forgotten. All right. One other thing I want to talk about is, well, there's a couple, but the next one is this news from the Labor Department earlier this week, yesterday, I think, that the economy actually in the year that ended this past March added almost 500,000 more jobs than we thought. And I bring it up for this reason. It puts President Obama in a position where he can now say, we have added jobs in this economy since I became president. Net-net, overall, we have added jobs. Will that, John, change the it's the economy stupid conversation we're having in this election?
I don't think it really does. The one thing to keep in mind is that is a terrible thing to have to brag about, that you just barely didn't lose more jobs made overall. I think that what's really happened overall is that the economy has been showing some signs of life until perhaps very recently, and that's helped Obama a lot. The economy was stronger. Americans feel a little better about the economy, or at least they did for most of the year.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really – I don't think it's this technical change of the Bureau of Labor Statistics adding back some numbers that's going to make a big difference.
All right, I want to get to the gut check thing in a minute, but Heidi, your sense on this jobs thing?
Yeah, you know, I think we depend too much on numbers, honestly. I mean, I think, you know, there was a philosopher in the 30s who said, you know, don't look at the map, look at the territory. And we have become obsessed with these economic maps, these numbers that are supposed to tell us where we are. Whereas if you look at the territory of the economy, really, this is not about Democrats or Republicans. It's about, you know, 14 or 15 million Americans out of work. So what is the solution for that as opposed to the positioning for an election?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's I mean, context is good, right? Okay. So on this feeling out there that the economy is or isn't getting better, I mean, the numbers are kind of mixed, right? You have consumer confidence rising, housing's coming back. We are adding jobs, but, you know, durable goods orders yesterday were lousy. There was fourth quarter GDP that came out. I mean, you know, John, what do you what does your gut tell you?
I'm very nervous. I had a meeting with some people from the Business Roundtable who had recently done a survey of CEOs who are very pessimistic about what's happening. Today we had the Chicago PMI numbers that measures manufacturing strength around the country. Those numbers showed that that's a contraction. Anything less than 50 is a contraction. So it said things are shrinking. I think the consumers might be the consumer sentiment number is probably a lagging indicator, and that all these businessmen making decisions about whether they're going to hire people or expand their business, that kind of information is showing a contraction, and I think that's bad news for us.
Heidi, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could kind of drive yourself crazy to see what's up and what's down. I mean, obviously, housing is doing really well. And the idea is that if housing improves, then all of us will magically feel rich. I'll admit I'm skeptical of this thinking.
Remember, housing hasn't even improved that much. All that's
right. It's just not terrible anymore.
Right. It's not it's not continuing to go down. Yeah. But there are still so many people whose houses are worth less than they owe it on that it will have to go up for several years before all those people can get some relief on their balance sheets.
We got to just plain go. Forget going up. Heidi Moore and John Carney in New York. Thanks, you guys. Talk to you later.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.
Psst. Hey, you.
Yeah. Yeah, you. You want to buy some manufacturing space? Well used, but still in good condition? Turns out General Motors is looking to unload more than 80 of its old factories. They were spun off after GM went bankrupt a couple of years ago, and now, after some refurbishing, buyers are starting to line up. From Red River Radio, Kate Archer-Kent has that story.
Gutting a vehicle assembly plant and erasing the GM footprint is a systematic task. Robots are disassembled, paint lines are broken down for parts, and giant climate-controlled presses are expertly salvaged. A worker collapses metal part racks. Dozens of GM employees are clearing out the Shreveport plant. It stopped producing pickup trucks in August. Racer Trust, the U.S. bankruptcy court-appointed receiver, owns this plant and more than 80 other former GM facilities around the country, primarily in Michigan. On a recent plant tour in a golf cart, the Trust redevelopment manager, Bruce Rasher, takes note of a neatly stacked mound of robots once used to build the Hummer H3. He doesn't know yet if the robots will be auctioned off or sold for scrap. Regardless, they'll be gone soon, and he can envision a massive vacant building that is highly marketable.
When a buyer walks into this plant, they see the same thing that I do, and that is the possibilities. You have to look beyond the equipment and superstructure that was installed by General Motors.
Rasher says he's followed up with hundreds of potential buyers. The portfolio even includes a 9-hole golf course GM built on top of a former ball bearing factory in Clark, New Jersey. He won't say what the asking prices are, but he does say that for all of these properties, the goal is the same.
We place a great deal of emphasis on the number of jobs created and how long it will take to create those jobs, probably more so than the purchase price.
And companies are ready to spend. In Greenville, South Carolina, Ed McCallum helps automotive and aerospace firms find new properties. McCallum says he's inundated with work. Manufacturers have slimmed down for so long, he says, that they must expand or lose out to the competition.
As the market starts turning around, which we think it is, matter of fact, we think it's significant, they can't wait. They have to manufacture. They have to start as fast as they possibly can.
The Cincinnati suburb of Norwood, Ohio, knows what it's like to lose GM and bounce back. But they didn't do it by luring a new manufacturer after their GM plant closed in the late 80s. They got GM to bulldoze the plant, and now it's a thriving multi-use development. Norwood Mayor Thomas Williams says idle factories are eyesores.
I would fight like the dickens to get them to take those plants down and clean that ground and move on. There's nothing worse than a shuttered plant to let sit there year after year.
But back at the Shreveport plant, Bruce Rasher says it would be a shame to take away millions of square feet of industrial space at a time when manufacturers are poised to grow.
It is not going to help a community if we were to sell this site to a company that makes its living by demolishing and selling buildings for scrap.
And the last thing he wants is more vacant industrial land on his books. In Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Coming up, you know, country music just isn't what it used to be.
Our entire goal is to make something that moves you. Now, if you don't want to consider it country, I really don't care.
All right, then. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 48 points today, a third of 1%. 13,437 is the number for the blue chips. The NASDAQ fell 20 points, 0.6%, 3116. The S&P 500 subtracted 6 points, 0.4%, 1440. At the bell. For the week gone by, the Dow off 1%, the NASDAQ nearly 2%, the S&P 500 1.3%. Accenture, the global consulting firm, gained 7% as it forecast higher earnings than expected. More than half its new orders are for outsourcing services, by the by, for other companies. Research in Motion was also up 5% today, but for the opposite reason, it lost less than expected. It's hanging in there while waiting for its new BlackBerries to come out sometime next year. Bond prices rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.63%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. We'll find out if Words with Friends made a double word score. Social media game company Zynga reports earnings. The Supreme Court is back from their summer break. Their last ruling before leaving for the recess was upholding the Affordable Care Act. And 50 years ago, Johnny Carson debuted as the regular host of The Tonight Show on NBC. I'm Bridget Botman.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here in California, one of the big fall election fights is over GMOs, genetically modified organisms. Voters are going to decide whether almost all foods with GMOs in them that are sold in California have to be labeled as such. Companies that make those foods are spending big against that ballot measure, as you might imagine. They say a GMO label would be something of a scarlet letter, or three of them, I guess, and that is quite possibly true. But it didn't always used to be that way, as Amy Standen reports now from KQED.
The year was 1994. Belinda Martineau was a scientist at a California-based biotech company called Calgene. And what she was working on, she thought, would change the world.
And we used to say, this is something we're going to tell our grandchildren about.
This was the Flavor Saver tomato, a tomato genetically engineered to solve a problem that had bedeviled farmers since the advent of the modern grocery store. How do you get a ripe tomato to the produce aisle without squishing it to a pulp? Now, usually farmers solve this by picking the tomatoes early while they're green and hard. But the Flavor Saver, it was genetically engineered to stay firm, even when it was ripe.
And that's why you could pick it while it was ripening and still get it to market without turning into a pile of goo.
This was the miracle of genetic engineering, and Calgene decided to market it that way.
We thought that if we were careful about it and transparent about it, that we could convince the public that they should be as enthusiastic about it as we were.
So when the Flavor Saver came out, Calgene labeled it to the hilt, even though they didn't have to, with a tag shaped like a tomato.
It actually explained the genetic engineering technology, and then it had a 1-800 number if people wanted to learn more.
And it worked. Flavor Savers flew off the shelves. In Davis, where Martineau lives, the local supermarket had to set a limit, 2 Flavor Savers per person per day.
How they kept track of that, I do not know.
Now, to Martineau, there is a lesson here. If the public understands the science, they will trust the science. But is that still true today? Because here in California, the current Calgenes of the world, the likes of Monsanto and DuPont, seem to see things very differently. In fact, they have spent tens of millions of dollars lobbying against the very same labels that the Flavor Saver wore as a badge of pride. And a lot of scientists feel the same way. Take, for example, Kent Bradford.
I'm a professor in plant sciences at UC Davis.
Bradford is a plant scientist, a developer of genetically modified crops. He works out at the experimental greenhouses on the edge of campus.
711, okay. We're looking for 708.
Bradford sees labeling in a very different light.
It absolutely plays on fears.
When customers see those made with GMO labels, Bradford says he knows exactly what they're going to think.
Why would they be putting this on the label if it weren't something that I should be concerned about?
Bradford may be a pessimist, but he may also be a realist. If Californians approve the labeling law, we will soon find out. So, whatever happened to the Flavor Saver, that game-changing tomato genetically engineered to be both ripe and firm?
It didn't actually work that way.
In the end, public perception didn't kill the Flavor Saver. It was the technology that failed. The tomatoes didn't stay firm. They had to be handled like peaches.
It was costing the company $10 a pound to get them to market, and they were selling them for $1.99 a pound.
And that was a problem that no label in the world could solve. In San Francisco, I'm Amy Standen for Marketplace.
You know what you get when you play country music backwards, don't you? You get your dog back, you get your house back, you get your girl back. It's pretty good, huh? It's my favorite joke, actually. You know, it's easy to make fun of country music, but the fact is, it's an enormous business. It brings in billions of dollars a year. And if one music label CEO has his way, country might be on the leading edge of how money in all kinds of music is parceled out in the digital age. That CEO is Scott Borchetta. He runs the Big Machine Label Group in Nashville, Tennessee. Scott, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
How did you get your start? How did it come to be that you're a country music impresario now, I think is the word I've heard used?
It was a beautiful accident. I grew up in Southern California, skate punk, motocross.
Wow. That's
racing.
Like as far from country music as you can get, man.
Oh, yeah.
And then you fast forward a couple of years, and in what, 2005, 2006, you start Big Machine, right?
September 1st, 2005.
I want to play the only Taylor Swift song I'm ashamed to admit to you that I know, but you know, so long as I know one, I figure that's good for you.
Well, we can fix that.
I want to play it, and then I want to ask you something. Here's a little bit.
She wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts. She's cheer captain, and I'm on the bleachers, dreaming about the day when you wake up and find that what you're looking for has been here the whole.
So this is a woman who eventually becomes the Country Music Association Artist of the Year. And I have to ask you, isn't that a little more pop than country? I mean, how do you figure out what country is?
It's whatever fans of country music listen to and like. So it's younger, it's youth. But if you go back over the years, and I'm just the current one in a long line of being considered trying to kill country music.
Yeah, well, you were actually called, what, the Antichrist, right? You were called the Antichrist of country music.
Yeah, I'm sure. But if you go back, you know, Patsy Cline was taking bullets.
Really?
You know,
I love Patsy Cline.
Well, if you go back and read up, you'll see that her records were so pop-sounding, and oh my gosh, this just can't happen. This can't be.
I walk for my.
And then you had Kenny Rogers, and then you had Shania Twain, and it's a big deal. You know what? It gives everybody something to talk about, something to write about. You know, our entire goal is to make something that moves you. And I don't think anybody can argue with the fact that Taylor moves you. Now, if you don't want to consider it country, I really don't care. That means nothing to me.
Is that not blasphemy, though, in Nashville? I mean, do people cross the side of the street to not walk next to you because of that?
Well, you know what? We've been so blessed at the Big Machine Label Group. We got people crawling over the wall to get in, so I don't feel it.
This deal you guys did with Clear Channel over the summer, which is being talked about as sort of a new paradigm for digital music. It's all about royalties and payments, right, for both regular radio and online performance, digital performance. What did it do?
Reba McEntire, who does not write her own music, now she will get paid for songs that she's been performing for years.
We're at a crossroads.
When you say digital radio, to be clear, you're talking internet streaming and online performance, right? Online radio.
Correct.
I'm going to guess you don't care where the music plays, right? You're not wrapped up in, oh, it's got to be on the radio or it's got to be online. You want it out there so people can hear it.
Yeah, well, radio is still the number one place for discovery. It's just not the only place. So we want to be everywhere.
So what's next for Big Machine?
A lot. We're probably on the eve of another announcement of a major broadcast company joining us in the performance rights world. We've got an amazing new Taylor album coming out on October 22nd. We are working on all kinds of amazing things for 2013. So we should probably set a date to talk again in January because
yeah, right.
Some amazing things coming your way.
Scott Borchetta is the president, founder, and CEO of Big Machine Label Group out of Nashville, Tennessee. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, one near and dear to my heart. It seems what beer you drink might say something about the slant of your politics and how likely you are to vote. The folks over at the National Journal have done some analysis. Heineken is the most Democratic beer. Scheiner Bock, the most Republican. You can check out the graphic from the National Journal on our website. It's pretty cool. Marketplace.org. But here's my gripe. Most of the beers they surveyed, nothing but fizzy, yellow, watery stuff. The craft beers are all lumped in as one. So set them free. The good beers. The real beers. Come on. All right. That's it. We're done. Our theme music, composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend, a co-production with the BBC. It's been 4 years, almost exactly, since Lehman Brothers went under, and we are still arguing about whose fault it was.
People talk about predatory lenders, and there certainly were. There also are predatory borrowers.
Join us for a special BBC Marketplace show in front of a live audience exploring who is to blame for the financial crisis and whether we, the people, just get the banks we deserve. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.